Hey everybody, welcome back to the next issue. My name is Mike.
And I'm Craig.
And today we are joined on the line by a creator that we are very much fans of. He's written books like Butcher Baker, Godland, Officer Down, Nixon's Pals. He's done for hire work on things like Cable and X-Men, Youngblood, Wildcats. Mr. Joe Casey. Joe, how are you, sir?
Aloha. I'm good. How are you?
Oh, I am well, too.
Yeah.
So this is coming out just days before Catalyst Comics hits shelves from Dark Horse. And it is quite the little comic. You got a small army working on it with you. And it's a very interesting approach. I enjoyed it very much. Can you tell the folks a little bit about it? Like, tease it a little bit?
Well, it is me writing with three artists, Dan McDade, Paul Mayberry, and Ulysses Farinas. And we are taking some of the superhero characters from Dark Horse in the 90s. They did a line of books called Comics Greatest World. And we're taking some of those characters and giving them a little spit and polish and seeing if we can make them work for right now. That's the goal anyway.
I think it works real well. Before we had you on the line, we talked a little bit about the tone and where we think some of the influences come from it. But first I want to just talk about the format of it. It feels very much like an anthology, and not just in you working with three different artists, but in, I feel like you have a real knack for shifting tone and shifting the way you approach story for each of the separate parts. Right. So when the idea for this first came up, was this immediately how you wanted to approach it, or was this something that you rolled around with Dark Horse for a little while?
Well, it morphed out of a different project with different characters that was going to be more of a mini line of books. And as circumstances changed, I still wanted to work with these different artists, and the type of comic book that we wanted to do never changed. It just got compressed and put into one book, which is ended up being for its benefit, I think, because it's a book that has a lot of energy and has a lot of shit flying around, mm-hmm. you know, bouncing off each other. Yeah. And so it was kind of circumstance that brought us to this place, but it was a good thing that it did, because I think the book is a lot better for it.
Yeah, in reading it, there's a real energy to it, even though there's sort of three separate, it's like an album. They're like three, or I guess it's like a single. Like, there are three different songs on it, and they all may be in sort of the same genre, but they all have their own sort of take to it. But when you take it sort of as a whole, and you listen to all three of them, you're like, oh, okay, that's, you know, I think really works well together to give like a really satisfying sort of experience in a way that it wouldn't be if it had been like three issues of, you know, of like the little Catalyst line or so. I think compressing
right.
them into like one, you know, one issue really accentuates that and really sort of throws you in. It's like, okay, boom, you know, a two minute sort of, you know, rock craziness and then done. All right. You know, sort of.
Well, I like the musical analogy, and I'll take it further. I mean, it's really, we approach this comic with a real garage band mentality. In my opinion, not a lot of superhero comics have that mentality anymore. They're very controlled and very focused, tested, and very refined to what the, you know, the companies who are publishing them want to put out.
Mm-hmm.
Their IPs, as opposed to expressions of art.
Mm-hmm.
And we wanted to get back to a superhero comic that was still an expression of art, an expression of energy, an expression of unpredictability. There's not a lot of them out there anymore. So hopefully mm-hmm. we're doing our part to bring it back a little bit.
I think...
Oh, go ahead.
Oh, go ahead, Greg.
I think it's funny you mentioned IPs because these aren't, I mean, these aren't creator-owned characters. These are, in fact, IPs, but they're IPs for a company that's not owned by a, you know, mega corporation. Was there, in sort of, I guess, in taking these characters, you know, that weren't your creations, was there anything sort of different between, I don't even know if I necessarily have a question there, but it almost in the way that, like, you know, when Alan Moore was going to do Watchmen, he was going to take the Charlton characters, and they're like, okay, look, no, you can't use the Charlton characters because they'll be radioactive after you use the story. You need to make your own. For this, it feels like you were kind of, you know, taking somebody else's characters, but not, you didn't have to kind of make up your own characters. You're allowed to sort of use those toys. Was there any sort of, maybe not trepidation on Dark Horse's part, but like was there trust? Obviously, there was trust there, but how was that?
Yeah, like what kind of guidance did Dark Horse give?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you're right. They are IPs. They're Dark Horse's IPs. And I think it's important to make sure that's out there. Because the important part about the comic is that, for me, is that you can take company-owned IPs and still infuse a real personal point of view as a creator, as a writer, as an artist, whatever. And in terms of what you're asking, I'd kind of gotten Dark Horse pregnant with the idea of this type of comic when it came to the earlier iteration of what this was going to be.
Okay.
I said, I want to take these certain characters, which were different than these characters, and do them in this sort of underground, left of center kind of way. And that was most of the discussion at first, which was the approach, which I was pretty clear about from the beginning. So when it came to basically moving over to these Comics Greatest Worlds characters, that approach just stuck. And I said, hey, I'm happy to do, you know, Frank Wells and Amazing Grace and the Agents of Change. They're great characters, but I still want the method I was going to use on the previous project to carry on with this one. And luckily, they were fine with that. And I didn't even know at the time that they were going to do, you know, Ghost and X and Captain Midnight and all the other things they're doing and make it more of a line of books. I thought it would be this book and it would be kind of its own line. So it was interesting to see that how weird we really were, even compared to the other books that have come out already, which are fine books, but definitely more straightforward if you compare it to what we're doing.
Now, in keeping with what you're doing and comparing it to sort of the other Comics Greatest Worlds books that have been released so far, I think you're right in that it seems like those books have more of a modern sensibility. But when Greg and I were going back and forth about this first issue, I kind of came to the conclusion that it has a very like late 70s sort of feel in terms of sensibility, but through more of an 80s lens.
Like, is that? Oh, I guess it's your question.
No. I mean, like, is that sort of accurate? Is that the influence you're drawing from in this?
I don't know if that's such a direct influence. I mean, those comics are the books that I grew up on, so they're part of my DNA, I guess, is to use a cliche.
Mm-hmm.
If I can cut loose, those influences will come out, whether I like it or not. And fortunately, I like it, so I don't try to suppress them or hold them back. The ironic thing to me about your question, really, is that I consider what we're doing to be really ultra-modern compared to other superhero comics and even other, you know, books in the Dark Horse line. I feel like we're maybe either, you know, somewhat ahead of the curve or just right on the spot of where superhero comics should be. I mean, I wouldn't have done it otherwise if I didn't feel that I had that take on the material and on the genre and just the kind of comic book that, you know, I think all superhero comics should be like this. That's basically what I'm trying to say. You know, and this is, I'm in a position where I can actually make that vision a reality that other people can hopefully buy and enjoy. So that's, if I'm going to do work for hire stuff, it's going to be on that level. I'm going to try to play on that level because it's the one aesthetic that I've held on to the past couple of years, and I feel like I can keep pushing further, is that getting, you know, different kinds of artists to do superhero material that probably, I mean, you're not going to see Paul Mayberry drawing Iron Man anytime soon. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I would love that. I would love to see Paul drawing Iron Man. I'd buy that shit every month. But it's not going to happen. I mean, it's just not the world that we live in. So to be able to bring these artists into a more, you know, mainstream arena with these characters, that to me, that's a big deal. That's pushing an aesthetic that hopefully will take more root, and more people will do it, and we'll see more of this kind of book in the future. It's kind of, I don't know, it's a little maybe pompous to put it in those terms, but I really feel that way, you know.
No, I think when Mike and I were sort of banding that about, the 70s and the 80s thing sort of came about by, like, in the 80s you had, you know, the real sort of explosion of a real sort of overground independent scene where you'd had, you know, American Flag and you know, Grendel and a bunch of these this license to bring in other ideas and other art styles and other sensibilities into, you know, maybe things that had been kind of laying around in the 70s. So when you are talking about thinking of it as like an ultra modern approach to this with Catalyst Comics, I think that's right. I think it, you know, your career, I mean, I guess being a child of the 70s and 80s, I think you're taking that type of 80s sort of license to be able to really sort of look at something and saying, okay, we're not bound to necessarily these certain tropes and these certain things because we were doing them a certain way. And like, I want to bring in fresh influences. I want to bring in, you know, at the time it would have been 80s, but now I want to bring in Paul Mayberry. I want to have, you know, Rafael Grampa do a cover, you know, for this, right, for ostensibly a, you know, a quote superhero unquote, you know, sort of type. That, I think that, you know, the 80s sort of taught us that was kind of okay, but I think people sort of stopped doing it after a while. And Catalyst Comics. Oh, go ahead.
Well, it's interesting you say that because I totally agree. I mean, I think that the parallel to the 80s right now, the 80s were a time when mainstream superhero comics, the big two publishers, except for a couple of select comics, a couple of writer artists that were doing good stuff on those characters, the majority of them were pretty boring, and weren't doing too much. So the independent comics that were coming out from, you know, Kimiko and First and Pacific Comics and then Dark Horse a little bit later in the decade, that really saved the medium, I think. And you saw this loop start to happen where when mainstream comics got boring, the indie scene was really happening and some great stuff was kind of bubbling up from the underground. A few years later, those independent creators then went to Marvel and DC and started doing things at those companies that were exciting. And, you know, it those things influenced each other. And I think we're at that same point in history. I mean, things go in cycles all the time anyway.
Right.
So we're now at this point again where maybe the mainstream stuff has gotten a little stale, a little tired, a little predictable. And now we have, you know, luckily in place, you know, the Image Comics, this Dark Horse, you know, Oni and IDW and all these, you know, independent publishers that can be daring and really push the envelope. And in a few years, that underground will become the mainstream. I mean, that's just how that cycle goes. So I'm quite proud to be part of the underground at this point because that's where the best stuff is.
I completely agree.
You know,
I've stumped you both.
I was like, I wasn't expecting him to agree quite that much. Okay.
You know, it's interesting. I think the idea of what was once underground becoming mainstream, and the idea of cycles. So, and you say that what you're doing in Catalyst is the direction that you want to see superhero comics go. But if you were a gambling man, would you say that it is in fact the direction it's headed?
Well, I can't say, because I'm not really good at predicting those things. Mm-hmm. I can only go by what I believe. I mean, really the precursor to this was doing Haunt with Nathan Fox, mm-hmm. for McFarlane's company. Mm-hmm. That was a situation where I took an artist, again, that's not considered mainstream, even though Nathan is brilliant, mm-hmm. and putting him on a property that we did not own. It was a work-for-hire gig that really had – I don't know what the expectation was when the original team left, when Kirkman and Greg Capullo left that book. I don't know if there was any expectation, but I don't think anybody predicted that it would be – myself and Nathan coming on and just doing our take on that material and turning that book somewhat upside down. Now, that ended up not working for that audience. It might have been too far afield. It might have been too bizarre or too weird. But I'm proud that those issues exist and that there are people that might stumble onto them, you know, years from now and see that there were guys that were in there trying. You know, and I think that, you know, I don't think the same fate will befall Catalyst Comics as it did the Haunt. I think I've gotten better at calling some of those plays. But again, you know, in predicting what's going to happen, that's for guys like you to take a shot at. You know, I just kind of, I feel like I'm in there hopefully making the raw materials for people to, you know, put together this part of comic book history and make some sense out of it, you know?
Yeah. I feel like for a lot of people, you know, like if they're familiar with his work, like they'll see a name like Ulysses on this book, you know? Yeah. If they're familiar with his work, I feel like there may be like a disconnect, like superheroes, I don't understand. But once you see it in action, it makes perfect sense. You know, mm-hmm. I think his work is incredibly strong on this. It was probably the strongest I've seen from him. And yeah, I mean, so if it is up to guys like me to say, I would say then yes, probably.
And Ulysses' sensibility is not just, I mean, it's not just in his art and the storytelling, whatever. He redesigned all those characters. So it's really his point of view is really infused in those characters now. It wasn't, we didn't just hand him the characters, here, draw these guys. Mm-hmm. You know, he and I got together and said, well, here are the characters. There's War Maker, there's Rebel, there's Ruby, and Wolf Hunter, which was another character we sort of adapted into this comic. And he did designs and we talked about them, and it was creative and collaborative and he was able to own those characters artistically, as opposed to just drawing from some corporate model sheet. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. That to me was exciting too. I mean, it brought some investment on Ulysses' part, and that's all the artists from Dan and Paul. They all basically, we all got together and redesigned these characters. You know, and that was always the first step. And I think if anything, this book would have been a big failure if it just seemed like some 90s rehash, which I know are more and more in vogue now, mm-hmm. that we're 20 years out from it. But I want it to be a next step, you know?
Mm-hmm. What sort of thought went into which artist would do what feature?
Well, let me think. I felt like the matchups were based on not only these artists' strengths, which are obvious, but their potential as well. Paul and I had a lot of talks about, you know, just the idea of a strong female superhero character. You know, there aren't enough of them out there. So that was sort of our guiding principle. And because he was invested in that idea as well, so it made perfect sense that he draw the Amazing Grace strip. Dan McDade, he's got that kind of, you know, Kirby bigness to his art. So it made sense to give him the kind of, you know, big Kirby character, the big, you know, Superman archetype character. Because Dan's art kind of lends itself to this big canvas, this epic canvas. And, you know, Ulysses is so detail-oriented that I like the idea of putting him on a team book idea to have his character sort of interacting with each other. So it pushed his art one step beyond, I think, what people expect when they look at his art, which is that kind of that Where's Waldo mentality of his art, where you're really looking at all the intricate stuff that he puts in there. I wanted to apply that to actual characters that were going to interact, that you would really get invested in. So it's, you know, it's one of those things where there was some thought put into it, but now that we're this deep into it, I can't imagine playing musical artist chairs with those guys and those characters. It seems like each one fits perfectly with the strip that they're drawing.
And they'll each get the first feature spot through this, right? Like the idea is that the stories will rotate through.
1 through 3 is Frank Wells in the pole position. 4 through 6 is Amazing Grace as the lead, and then 7 through 9 is Ages of Change as the lead story.
And then it'll repeat, or is that sort of the story that you're setting out to tell?
Well, we're doing 9 issues, and then we'll see how it goes.
Okay. Well, I hope.
I'd like for it to continue. I think everybody would like for it to be successful enough to keep going, but you know, not at the expense of quality. So it's nice to kind of feel like, okay, let's do these 9 issues, make them as great as we can, and. So if it never goes any further, we have this chunk of work that we're all really proud of, you know?
Yeah. Well, I hope it goes for a while. I mean, your work, I mean, the team of artists on this are guys that I am very impressed with. Some of the other players in this book, Brad Simpson on color and Russ Wooten on letters, these are folks that you've worked with previously, and they're names that have popped up a couple times in some of the other books that you're doing. And that got me thinking a little bit. Like, it's interesting. Like, I feel like colorists and sometimes letterers, like you kind of see them come packaged with artists, but it's not super often, I think, that you see writers that have a go-to colorist and a go-to letterer. Can you kind of talk a little bit about your relationship with them and sort of the working with them?
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been working with Russ. He's lettered all my image books and some of my work for hire books probably for the last 6 years. And he's a great collaborator. Every new project, you know, we're able to get together and go, how do we want to approach this? What style do we want to go with? And he's very open to that. So he's great. Brad, I met through Nick Dragotta when we did the Vengeance series for Marvel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that, I believe, was one of Brad's first gigs as a colorist. And he knocked it out of the park. And he was, again, a great collaborator. Dragotta really whooped him into shape. And So I hired him to do the Sex series and then got him on this. I mean, he's just really great. Very, again, very collaborative. We talk about, you know, with each thing, you know, we at the outset, just like I do with Russ, I talk about, well, what approach do we want to take with this? Well, how can we make this book its own thing? And with the Catalyst book, it was, how do we make each strip its own thing? How do we approach 3 different artists with 1 colorist, and yet each Each strip has its own identity, has its own look, has its own palette. And again, he did a great job. I mean, I'm really impressed. And he really brings an artistry to comic book coloring. And these things, you know, especially in the work for hire realm, these things can seem very assembly line. Like the writer does his gig, and then the penciler does his gig, the inker does his gig. And, you know, none of these things sort of cross-pollinate as much as probably the creators involved would like them to, but the nature of the beast is just keep it moving, keep it moving. We got deadlines to meet. We got to get this book out on the stands. So I try to get with these guys as early as possible, so everyone feels like they have enough time to really get into the project, really get invested, and really feel like they're bringing a piece of themselves to it. And it's worked out so far, you know. I mean, I feel like we're out of the, you know, fill-in-the-blank driven comics. At the big two publishers, they're fairly editorially driven. And everywhere else, they're not driven by anything except the passions of the creators involved. You know, I've been trying to figure out a way to describe it. It's almost like, to me, they're end product driven. What does the end product look like? How special is the final thing that we've all, you know, poured our energies into? And I think readers can tell when that energy is not there, and they can tell it subliminally when, you know, a letterer phones it in, or a colorist phones, or any part of the process. Whenever that's phoned in, I think it makes a difference. Even if it's sort of subliminally, readers pick up on that stuff. They go, something about this book didn't quite have the juice or whatever. And even if they can't put their finger on it, it's usually because at some part of the process, whether it was by choice or by design, somebody didn't just give it all they had when it came to their part of the creation of the book. So I carefully choose my collaborators all down the line to make sure that everybody is wants to get in there and really do good work. Because otherwise, you know, what are we doing it for?
Mm-hmm. How often do you sort of fall into the role of editor then, you know, in working with Brad or even any of your artists, your line artists?
Well, they're gracious enough to show me things in progress, work in progress, and confident enough to, you know, I mean, they're confident enough in their skills to let me, you know, make suggestions or at least comment on what they're doing. And a lot of it is just me going, that's genius. That looks great. I love that. You know, mm-hmm. But occasionally I'm able to chime in with maybe something that's, you know, a minor suggestion or a tweak. It's really just another set of eyes on the material. I guess it's kind of a de facto editor, but I see it not as that I'm in any kind of supervisory role. I'm just there to be maybe a backstop to things, you know. And I'm also, once I've written it, now I can sort of be the big picture guy, you know, which is like, is everything contributing to the end result being as good as it can be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm a big process junkie, and I love the creation of comic books. I love what it takes from everybody's skill set to make the thing work. So it's a real kind of a privilege for me to be able to be there for every step of the process and see it all come together, and whatever part I play in those steps is really, like I said, again, it's due to my collaborators' you know, gracious nature to allow me to do that stuff.
That's one of the things. Oh. That's one of the things, looking back on your career, that I noticed early on, that you always seem to have a you either were working on projects that seemed to be able to kind of break out of a mold in some way, or when you were given a project yourself, you always seemed to have like a sort of a different sensibility with it. I'm thinking like back to like Wildcats, I guess 2.0, mm-hmm. where the covers and stuff would have like different, you know, like really completely different designs and things. And then with 3.0, working with Ryan Hughes, it's like you almost didn't need, like, there was no like standard Wildcats cover, but it was almost standard because it was different every time.
Yeah.
And then even going forward to this with Catalyst Comics and with both your Image books, Sex and the Bounce, both look very different from each other and from anything else that's on. And then even the Catalyst Comics work, looks different from even sort of the other comics that are in kind of the World's Greatest Comics line simultaneously. I guess, is there anything like specifically where you were like, I'm going to, I guess there's not even necessarily a question there.
Well, I think I know what you mean. I mean, I had a weird, okay. I had a weird trajectory in comics in terms of my career, which is I fell in at Marvel and DC fairly early in my career and worked on very high profile books very early. I mean, to me, it seemed early. Now it seems like you can, you know, bust in at Marvel and DC and the next thing you know, you're writing high profile books. But when I, you know, for me, I was quite shocked that I was, you know, writing the X-Men after, you know, 4 or 5 years in the business, you know, and writing Superman after 4 years in the business. That blew me away. And because to me, those, you know, those kind of Cadillac IPs, the crown jewels in the Marvel and DC, you know, publishing pantheon, those were gigs that you worked your way up to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it seemed to be the pecking order, right? I mean, you'd start off, you know, on some, you know, lower tier title, and you know, if you did good work on that and things go well, you get to the middle tier title, you know, like, you know, back then it was like you could get on like Iron Man or you know, Daredevil before Kevin Smith wrote it or whatever, you know.
Right. But you went
and
from like
there, if you did great on that, you know eventually maybe you'd get a lower tier X book, and then if you did good on that, you'd get the X-Men title. Well, I kind of did that stuff in a very compressed amount of time.
Yeah.
So once I kind of hit those career peaks, and had gained, I guess, a certain amount of recognition in the business and some visibility, my name had gotten out there to a pretty good degree, I started to think, well, okay, now what can I do with this? If there's any, you know, I mean, it's all kind of nebulous and ethereal, you know, power.
Mm-hmm.
In the business, really, from an artistic point of view, creative point of view. But if you have anything that amounts to some currency in the business, what are you going to spend it on? And for me, I realized early on, I was like, well, I'm going to spend it on doing work that is individualistic, you know, unique, you know, as opposed to things around it. If I'm going to do something that's going to be personal to me, then it's going to be to buck trends. Or I used to joke about it that if something was a popular trend, I would go out of my way to do almost the exact opposite of it, which is where the big joke is where, you know, I did a book at Wallstrom called The Intimates. And the big joke there was, this was when I pitched that book and I came up with that idea, it was the, it was around 2003 maybe, and the big thing in comics was the Ultimate line. You know, the Ultimates was the big comic of the day. And I thought, well, what's the opposite of the Ultimates? Well, maybe the Intimates. The Ultimates is a big bombastic, over the top movie on paper. You know, big Michael Bay, you know, sort of blockbuster movie. I'm gonna do small character stuff, still with superheroes, and still with all the color and the excitement of a superhero comic, but I'm going to do the exact opposite of what the Ultimates are doing. And of course, you know, sales reflected that. That was the exact opposite. But I felt like at that point, and I still feel this way, I'd had my moment in the mainstream spotlight, and it hadn't. It wasn't bad, but I don't know how good of a fit it was for me, and I'm sure a lot of readers would probably agree. This kind of work is much more comfortable for me. It's much more where my heart and soul is as a fan, as what I've loved growing up, and so I've used whatever name recognition I got at the working at Marvel and DC all those years. This is the payoff now. The work I've been doing in the last, you know, 3-4 years is the payoff of that time spent on Uncanny X-Men and Adventures of Superman and the Hulk and whatever else I wrote back then. You know what I mean? This is I've earned my chance to do this kind of work. This is the chance. These are the chances. These are the creative chances I've earned doing all that stuff, you know, for the past, you know, decade.
So when you sort of earn that capital, you know, that recognition based on your superhero work, and you set out to, like, all right, now I'm going to do the things that I want to do. Who were some of the first artists that you were like, oh man, if I could work with this guy, or if this person's available?
That's a good question. It hasn't been until recently that I've sought out artists that I've been a fan of. I guess the first guy that I really went out of my way to meet and see if we could work together was Nathan Fox. Met him at a San Diego con probably about 5 years ago, something like that. And said, hey, I'm a big fan of your work, and, you know, hopefully we can do something together. We met and got on, and we started talking about things, and then opportunities came up that I was able to pull him in on the first one being the Zodiac series I did at Marvel, where I pitched that project and that thing was up and running, and I was able to go, hey, I there's this artist, Nathan Fox, who had done work, you know, by that point that I could point to. So the editor on that project, Tom Brevoort, was like, yeah, you know, get him and see how it goes. So that was the first guy that I had known about. I mean, I had known Nathan's work at that point for a few years. And he had done some things, and then he seemed like he wasn't in comics for a while, and then he was back in comics, and that's kind of when I pounced. So that was, I think that was the first guy. Before that, I just felt very lucky to work with new artists that hadn't done a lot of stuff. I think I was one of the first guys to work with, well, I was one of the first guys to work with Ladrone way back when on Cable.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was one of the first guys to work with Dustin McGuinn on Wildcats 3.0. The first guy to work with Giuseppe Camuncoli on The Intimates. So I was never one of those guys that tried to, to be brutally honest, further my own career by working with the quote unquote A-level artists. Mm-hmm. Those guys are great, but they have their gigs, and it just wasn't mine to kind of chase after, you know, the Brian Hitches, the, you know, Steve McNivens, or the, you know, John Romita Jr.'s of the world, and say, hey, you know, work with me so I can be elevated. And I'm fans of all those guys, but I've always been really careful not necessarily to work with people that I'm huge fans of. Like, early on, the only guy that I worked with that was a legitimate hero of mine was Steve Rude. I worked with him on Children of the Atom.
Oh, yeah.
And that was an amazing experience to work with him. He's a fantastic artist. I mean, he's been one of my favorite artists since I was, you know, a teenager, young teenager. But other than that, I've been very careful not to work with my heroes because I want them to stay my heroes. And there's one way to make sure that somebody who is your hero is not your hero anymore is to really to get too close to them. And that's not a knock on anybody, but no. That's just the nature of, you know, working relationships.
Mm-hmm.
So, okay, so if I'm not going to work with my heroes, then I'm going to work with new guys who haven't done much but are really hungry and have a real singular style. I was one of the first guys to work with Javier Pulido, who's an amazing artist. So I'm much more proud of some of the initial relationships I've had with artists over the years, and now I'm more than ever committed to a type of artist, again, going back to what I said at the beginning, who probably are not going to be tapped to do those mainstream superhero gigs. You know, they're just not. And I don't agree with that assessment of their talent, so I'll do what I can to work with them and put them in situations that compete with the kind of material that superhero comics really excel at, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it's become a personal aesthetic that I'm just trying to, you know, at every opportunity I kind of push and push. And the ironic thing is, if you look at the work I'm doing now, my creator-owned stuff actually is more mainstream in the art department than my work for hire stuff, you know, which I kind of get a big kick out of, because it's, you'd think it'd be the other way around. But I really think that when it comes to work for hire, that's the time to really push the envelope and take those chances. You know, just push it as far as you can, because those areas of the business do resonate with a big section of the readership. Mm-hmm. You know, so to really, you know, plant those seeds for the future is, you know, it's important. You know, it's important to me anyway.
See, now that's interesting, because I feel like it kind of, that idea, to bounce off of what you were saying before about not working with your heroes, I feel like the people you're working with and have worked with have gone on to become sort of the next generation of artists' heroes. You know, like besides the folks you've mentioned, like I think about guys like Mike Huddleston and Tom Scioli.
Chris Burnham and
you know, like these guys that definitely do go on to influence a younger generation. I guess what I'm trying to say is maybe you're a kingmaker.
Well, I have good taste. That's how I like to look at it. You know,
I'd say impeccable. But also, I want to mention real quick the back matter in Sex Number 3, where you call for Michael DeForge to do an Alpha Flight series.
I say he should not do one. I say he probably doesn't want to do one.
Oh.
But I think it would be interesting as hell to see.
Well, it would be. No, that was – I was actually taken now I'm blanking on his name. The guy who does Copra and Zegas.
Mikhail Fife.
There you go.
Yeah.
That's right. I feel like an ass for not remembering. Yeah. Okay. I was taken from Fife's online article about Fusion Comics, and he had put forth this notion that yes, it would be interesting, it'd be fantastic to see Michael DeForge do Alpha Flight, but you still have to take into account whether or not Michael DeForge would have any interest in doing Alpha Flight, you know.
Yeah.
And that's the interesting thing about where we are now, is that look, Dan McDade and Paul and Ulysses, they don't have any attachment to those Dark Horse characters. If they even knew them at all. I don't think Ulysses had any awareness of those characters. And I think we're starting to get to the point where young artists, new artists, that next generation, they're going to feel that way about the Avengers or the Justice League or, you know, any of those big Marvel and DC characters. They're just not going to have the fanboy attachment that, for instance, guys of my generation clearly have. You know,
mm-hmm.
And that's where it gets interesting, because when you can't dangle those carrots anymore, then what's left? I mean, how are you going to, you know, push those IPs into the future, at least in terms of the comics? So I'm real excited to see where things fall in the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, you have Marvel doing those Strange Tales anthologies, which use a lot of these sort of underground or mm-hmm. or alternative artists.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm hoping that in 5 years, the Strange Tales aesthetic will be the mainstream at Marvel and DC. You know, you'll have Raphael Grandpa doing Wolverine, you know, monthly or whenever he wants, and no one will bat an eye at that. You know.
See, I don't know how after that series came out that he did not at least get a miniseries.
Well,
out of it,
that
people were clamoring for it.
No, I agree, but then you got to factor in maybe he was offered and he just said, I'm not interested. I don't like Wolverine that much, you know.
Right.
But that's great because it's going to get back to you know, publishers having to actually convince artists that they feel are valuable to work on their IPs. That's how it should be. It shouldn't be, it shouldn't be a privilege to draw, you know, fucking Animal Man, you know?
Yeah.
It's a privilege to draw comics. It's a privilege to make comics. But I don't feel like any character should have that hold on a creator, you know? And believe me, I'm speaking from experience. I mean, after I did Uncanny X-Men, and that went not so great, I just thought, I'm just not going to work at Marvel anymore. I had nothing against Marvel at all, but I just decided to step away from that company and those characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd started to feel really good about myself. Like, I'd kind of done a lot of stuff at Marvel in my first couple of years working there. And I thought maybe I'd scratch that itch. But man, when, you know, they dangle that, you know, Avengers miniseries in front of my face, I bit. I was like, oh, the Avengers. You know, I mean, it worked.
Yeah.
And I jumped right back in because I love those characters so much. I don't think that the next generation that you're seeing have those loyalties. And it's great, you know. It's great. It'll be great when all the old guard is finally weeded out, or at least everyone comes to their senses and not feel, you know, brand loyalties or character loyalties or IP loyalties. I mean, it just seems bizarre to me that you would be like, I've always wanted to work on, you know, character X or whatever, and so I'll take a bad deal just for the opportunity to do it. You know, why? You know? I mean, especially now, I think that, did you guys ever see, this is a couple of years old now, but did you ever see that James Stokey Spider-Man strip that he did online?
Oh, yeah, the Vietnam one.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Oh.
Dude, I
love that.
It's
like my favorite Spider-Man comic of the last, you know, 10
ever.
Years.
Yeah.
But wasn't published by Marvel. Or what about, and Ulysses did it. Ulysses did a Batman sort of fan fiction comic that he posted online. It was fantastic, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I'd much rather read that than, you know, real Batman comics at this point.
So,
man, I'm getting way off topic. Where are we going?
No, it who knows?
Yeah, yeah.
But it's good.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, when you talk about like brand loyalty and the next generation of artists moving away from sort of the perceived brass rings, you know, the X-Men's and the Justice Leagues and stuff like that. Do you think that it's a shift away from that notion, or do you think it's a shift towards a different set of, oh man, if I can only do this?
You know what? I honestly don't know. I mean, I don't know. I'm not of that generation. I'm like of the generation before. I sadly admit that, where there were carrots dangled in front of me that I had emotional attachments to. So I bit, you know, and I can't sit here and say for certain that if another type of carrot was dangled in front of me, that I wouldn't bite at that one too. I don't know, but I just have that feeling that, you know, there are, you know, the guys that are coming up and the guys that we're starting to see doing significant work just don't have. I mean, look at Fife right there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is Copra but his riff on the Suicide Squad,
mm-hmm.
right? Everybody knows it. It's obvious. Not to mention the fact it was born out of a Suicide Squad fan comic that he did, which I thought was genius. Mm-hmm. My favorite DC comic of the past decade that DC Comics didn't publish. But there's a situation where a creator is tapping into his love of something, but not letting himself bite the carrot. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
He found a way around it, and I get that book every month. And, I just read issue, I think it was issue 7. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a direct lift of the Suicide Squad issue where it's the pastor or the reverend at Belle Reve who sort of talks to all the inmates and he's doing his riff on that particular issue. It's fantastic. I love it so much. But I'm so glad that it's something that he owns and that he's in complete control of and that he's serving no master other than his own, creative urge. And, I think more and more people are going to do that. More creators are going to be doing that, So it's fantastic. I mean, it's like we're at the, we're on the precipice of some major thing. I mean, I just feel it.
Yeah.
And I just, I'm just so happy that I'm in the business and able to create stuff alongside of whatever else is, happening. It's amazing.
Do you get out to many like small press or like independent shows or anything like that? Where do you find new comics to consume?
I just kind of keep my ear to the ground and things that are talked about online, I'll check out. And I kind of feel like it's probably not my place to go to things like SPX and things like that because, I don't know, I'd feel like I think people would see me as like a tourist or something, which I don't want to. I don't want to come across like that, And so it's that thing of, you don't want to just, again, it's sort of like the same mentality as not working with my heroes. I'm a big fan of what these new guys are doing,
Mm-hmm.
Benjamin Marr, I think that guy's fantastic.
He's great. Yeah.
And Night Business, I eat that shit up. I thought that was such a great comic. And but the best way to appreciate things that you love is to kind of keep your distance and allow yourself to just be a fan and that's it. So in terms of these new guys coming up, I'm very tentative about, stepping into their world. You know what I mean? They don't certainly don't need me hanging around. I just want them to keep doing what they're doing so I can enjoy it as a fan,
Mm-hmm.
Sounds kind of sad, but
I agree. I agree with the assessment of like there's being these sort of the two tracks of like the like the big two but also this sort of this generation of creators who are like doing their own thing and being sort of like unattached from sort of the big two track that's kind of keeping the market up. Do you think the market will be able to hold out long enough for the for this newer crop of creators to be able to finally like affect the sort of the changeover that you feel is coming?
I see what you're saying. Okay. I mean, I think it's going to be
because right now to me it feels like a race. It feels like a race between the big two is sort of doing their thing, but it's kind of not as steady as it used to be, but then we've got this big rush of new people coming in and like with Dark Horse, with Image and the underground stuff as well, like that sort of the third option is growing. And I'm like, man, I hope they can make it before the roof collapses, I guess.
The upside of what you're saying, I agree, is that what Marvel and DC have gotten very good at is making money.
Mm-hmm.
That's their really, that's why they're in business, is to make money. So they've gotten very good at it. So, you know, God bless them for putting out these event books that, that sell on the, you know, hundreds of thousands of copies, you know, and that keeps the retailers in business, and that keeps the outlets open. Mm-hmm. So God bless them. I mean, let them keep doing what they're doing. They're not obligated. I mean, I'm not, you know, I don't want to put too much of an onus on Marvel and DC, because it's not their job to make art. It's their job to sell comics and make money.
Right.
So they certainly make a lot of comics, and they certainly know how to make money. So I hope they just keep doing it, you know. And if they keep doing it in the way they're doing it, then, yeah, the third party is going to do just fine, because that's where the real action is. That's where the real artistry in the medium is happening. And so as long as these tentpole money makers, and I kind of like that maybe the big two publishers are not really even hiding behind the pretense of making lasting art. They're just saying, hey, here's a comic that you need to order a bunch of, and it's going to have a lot of variant covers and all kinds of crap, so that everyone makes money. Mm-hmm. It makes the economy of comics, you know, healthier than it's been in probably in a while.
Right.
Certainly healthier than it seemed 10 years ago or 15 years ago.
Yeah.
So I don't really feel or even sense a lot of doom and gloom out there, because the Marvel and DCs of the world, they're fairly confident in their ability to make money. So I say, you know, go forth and make that money, because it will serve the rest of us well. Now, eventually, the revolution will happen, and all the boats will be overturned. But I think that it'll happen in a very smart and measured way. But it's not about, you know, blowing up the direct market to save comics. No, it'll be about slowly taking over the direct market like a creeping virus. You mm-hmm. know, and before anyone knows it, you know, the Black Plague has arrived. You know, it's going to be great.
It'll be awesome. I think as soon as I think if we have a couple of major self-published hits, that'll be a huge tide change yeah. in the direct market. You know,
and I think Image Comics has that momentum, and they're doing it in a smart way. I mean, they're. You know, the big hits at Image mm-hmm. are right now big name creators coming over and doing their thing and selling a lot of comics. That's great. But the real I hate to do this because I know him so well and hate to give him so many props, but it's really that Robert Kirkman model of really coming from nowhere and just having the right idea at the right time and taking it to the fucking mountain, you know, mm-hmm. that's really, I can't imagine that there's not a generation of, you know, new creators or guys that just haven't quite broken in yet that don't look at the Kirkman model and go, that's the future. That's the way forward, you know, for all of us. And, you know, God bless him for showing the way. I mean, he's definitely, you know, personally, I think he's a son of a bitch, so he's not my personal role model, but, you know, for younger guys, you know, yes, definitely.
It seems like people in talking about the Kirkman model, the phrase the Kirkman model has almost become just as popular as the Mignola model in terms of how to do it independently.
Well, then I wish I hadn't said it. Did I actually use those words? God damn it.
Well, no, but I mean, I think the Kirkman model, I think, also works as a writer and stuff. Mignola, I think, works, but it's kind of a different track, I think, because he was sort of established and then did Hellboy, and then did that. Whereas Kirkman was basically like, look, I do Battle Pope in this, and then we're going to do this black and white zombie comic. And then it just, and then that, like, really takes off, you know.
Well, people forget that Kirkman had a lot of sort of disparate Image comics that he tried that didn't catch on. He did, like, a book called Tech Jacket.
Yeah, that's right.
He did Grit. He did, I think, something called Cloudfall. Just some weird shit that I don't even remember. So he definitely was just hacking away at that tree until he found the right thing, you know. And now we're in a situation where I feel like that's what gets new creators jazzed, is that they have these opportunities with the internet, with the market how it is, with digital comics or whatever, to just keep throwing ideas out there. And, you know, something will hit at some point, you know. I mean, it's just, if the thing about the quote-unquote Kirkman model is that you can't really apply it to everybody, because there's only one Kirkman. I mean, he's got his own thing going on, and he's singular in his talent and his point of view. God, I can't believe I'm saying so many nice things about that son of a bitch. But he did open up a train of thought that is like, the field's wide open if you're willing to take that chance and take that risk and just get your ideas out there, that, you know, everybody has as good a shot as anybody else of being successful at that level. And you don't even have to get that to that level to be successful. You know, that's the great thing about comics. You know, it's you can have sort of moderate success or moderate sales levels and do fine, you know. It's amazing that there's a meritocracy involved in creating comics that has never gone away, which is, if you can get to the point where your comic is in the store on Wednesday, then that thing that you thought up in your, you know, bedroom or your basement or whatever is sitting on the stands next to Justice League of America and fucking Fantastic Four and all that other shit that's been around for years, you know? And once it's in the store, it's anybody's guess, you know? That's where the meritocracy really happens. You just got to get in the store. And that's where I hope this next generation of guys do. That's the whole purpose of doing a Catalyst Comics, is to get a kind of material in the store. You know, so it's sitting there next to the Justice Leagues and the Iron Mans and the Avengers comics that are out there. You know, it stands just as much of a chance as anything of being bought and absorbed by readers.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, that's a hopeful time for comics, and I think that's a hopeful place to end it. I don't want to eat up any more.
Yeah,
of your evening, right. You've been more than generous, Joe.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, unless I'm stopping you and you're just getting started, I mean, I'll do another 3 hours.
No. You know what? I should stop before it really gets me into trouble. Before I say something else nice about Kirkman.
Oh, yeah, well, I wouldn't.
We wouldn't want that.
No, we wouldn't want him inviting you on the yacht or anything.
Sure.
So.